Thanks for joining us. I'm Frank Sesno, host of Planet Forward and director of the School of Media and Public Affairs at the George Washington University, sitting in for Diane Rehm today. She's visiting Interlochen Public Radio in Traverse City, Michigan. In an age of cheap long-distance rates, discount airlines, virtual internet communities, studies show that neighborhood ties, the old-fashioned kind of neighborhood, one person living next to the next, are diminishing. A tragedy on his street was the catalyst for journalist Peter Loewenheim to seek a deeper relationship with the people who lived on his block. He joins us in the studio to explain why he thought sleepovers at his neighbors' homes would be the best way to get to know them. He's author of a new book titled In the Neighborhood, The Search for Community on an American Street, One Sleepover at a Time. Peter Loewenheim, welcome.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
Sleepovers? Sleepover, I think of sleepovers as my kids when they were little.
Well, that's how the idea arose. But my book, my story really began with a tragedy on my street, as you mentioned. There was a family living down the street, a husband and wife, both physicians, with two children, a boy and a girl, 11 and 12. And one night the husband came home and shot and killed his wife and then killed himself. Their children fled from the house, screaming into the night. Soon after that, the children moved to another part of town with their grandparents, and the house was put up for sale. In effect, this whole family, who had lived on our street for 7 years, literally vanished overnight. And what struck me was how little effect that seemed to have on my neighborhood. I had not known the family well, and in asking around, I found that very few of the other neighbors knew them, and in fact, I found that most neighbors didn't know each other very well either.
So there's a murder-suicide literally down the street from where you live?
Correct.
How far from your house?
Oh, about maybe 8 or 9 houses down.
8 or 9 houses down?
Yes.
And after this terrible tragedy, and their kids, as you say, come running into the street, you look around and you think, we don't know one another.
Well, except for the appearance in front of their brick house of a for sale sign, I really didn't see anything in the neighborhood change. And I started to do some research after that. I found that on the last day of her life, my neighbor had frantically tried to reach by telephone her closest friend who lived in the city about 10 minutes away, possibly to take her children and sleep over at her friend's house that night because she was afraid of her husband at that point. What she didn't know was that her friend was out of town that day on a business trip. She stayed away from the house as long as she could. She even had the children do their homework at the public library. But about 9 o'clock, she came home with the kids, told them to go upstairs and do their and get ready for bed. Then her husband came home and he put a fire in the fireplace and started burning their mortgage papers. At this point, my neighbor had very few options because her husband had canceled her cell phone service earlier in the day and had disabled her car. It seemed to me that her only hope there was to get out of the house with the kids and go to a neighbor's. But she didn't do that. And I think the reason is she didn't know anybody well enough to seek shelter at their homes that night. So making this really a double tragedy. And it caused me to ask the question, do I live in a neighborhood or do I just live in a community surrounded by people whose lives are entirely separate from my own?
What interactions had you had with this family, with this woman, before this tragedy?
I knew them casually. They would often jog down the street together. I'd wave to say hello.
I mean, these were professional people.
Yes. Yeah, both physicians. My daughter and one of their daughters is about the same age, and sometimes we'd even carpool. But like the other neighbors, our contact was very casual.
Never had barbecues. You never had block parties. You never had them over to your house or to their house.
No.
And neither had others on the
neighborhood. No, and in that I'm just as guilty as the other neighbors in that sense.
So you launch on this idea, and you start your book with your teenage daughter calling you crazy.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you see your 50-year-old father leaving the house with an overnight bag to sleep over at the neighbors, I can understand my daughter saying, Dad, you're crazy.
And the neighbors that, as you launched on this, you realized you didn't know that well.
Right. But I didn't think I was crazy. I thought I spent a long time, actually, contemplating what to do. I felt that I wanted to deliberately see if I could get to know my neighbors so I would not be living among strangers. But exactly how to do that wasn't quite clear. As a journalist, I thought, well, I could just go interview people. But I really wanted to know them more than just, you know, what they did for a living and what their children's names and ages were. I really wanted to get to know them in a deep way as human beings.
Did you find, as you sent out on your mission, on your journey, that this murder-suicide on your street had changed other people and had struck other people as it had you?
Well, certainly everybody knew about it. And I made a point of asking all the people who I eventually got to know very well what their experience of it was. But I don't know that anybody was changed a great deal because, as I say, nobody knew this family very well.
What happened after this horrible murder-suicide is the kids ran out to the street, and they did run over to one of the neighbors' homes.
Yes, they did. And
they
were taken in by a next-door neighbor's family and, supported very appropriately. I mean, after the murder, some of the people in the neighborhood were very supportive, helping shelter the family, the surviving members of the family when they came for the funeral, providing food, that sort of thing. The problem was that before the tragedy, there really was not enough interaction to be supportive of this neighbor who really could have used our help that night.
As you launched on this sleepover journey of yours, you were operating from the assumption that what? This neighborhood was different than others? This neighborhood was much like the rest of America? That we've lost something or we've never had it? Where were you coming from in this sort of, I mean, the subtitle of your book, The Search for Community on an American Street. You were searching for community.
Correct.
Define that to start with.
Well, I think community means living with a common sense of humanity among the people closest to you, knowing the people well.
In your book, you take the word neighborhood apart. You define it.
Yes. I think the origin is agricultural. I think it means living in close proximity to another farmer, as I recall. That was the origin. But to answer your question, I think my street is representative of most neighborhoods in America today. Now, there certainly are some communities, some neighborhoods that have a strong community bond. And those are notable exceptions, however, to, I think, a general trend of not knowing our neighbors nearly as well as we did perhaps 50 or 60 years ago.
Do you feel we've lost neighborhood?
Yes, I think we have. I think the studies show that the number of times a person spends a social evening, for example, with a neighbor has declined a full 50% since 1950. Other studies show that measures of neighborhood contact have similarly declined in that period. So I think whether you live in a high-rise apartment in New York or Washington or an outer suburb with McMansions or a middle-class suburb, most people are experiencing a decline in their contacts with their immediate neighbors. And the question I ask is, what do we lose by that? Certainly in this tragedy, something very serious was lost.
We're talking with Peter Lovenheim. He's author of the book In the Neighborhood, The Search for Community on an American Street, One Sleepover at a Time. As we go on with our conversation, if you've got a question for him or a comment, you can email us at drshow@wamu.org. You can call us at 1-800-433-8850. Peter, let's talk about a couple of your characters in this book, a couple of people who you slept over with. There's Lou. Lou's really interesting.
Lou Gazzetta, one of my favorite characters in the book. Lou was a 81-year-old retired surgeon. He lived two doors down from me. He'd lost his wife 5 years earlier. All six of his children were adults and living elsewhere. And when I asked Lou if I could come over and talk to him, maybe write about him, his life, he said, sure, but it'll be boring. My life is zero. I don't do anything. That turned out not to be true. I found Lou a fascinating character. But it was accurate that he spent a lot of time alone at that point in his life. His wife had died. Like many Americans, actually, this current studies show that 25% of American households are occupied by just one person. That's more than double the figure of years earlier. So in that sense, Lou was representative of about 30 million Americans today who live alone.
How well did you know Lou before you showed up to sleep over?
I knew Lou a little bit because at that point I was living in what had been my childhood home.
You grew up here.
Yeah, I was away for 25 years, but moved back with my family. And I was friendly with Lou's son when I was very little.
So you were there as a kid.
Yeah.
But you hadn't. So when you call up Lou and say, hey, Lou, you mind if I come sleep over?
Well, first, I didn't quite make the approach that way. But to answer your question, I knew Lou just as the sort of distant father of my childhood friend. He struck me as always quite gruff and busy. And as a surgeon, he was at the hospital most of the time. So I can't say that I knew him at all well. But, you know, the origin of the sleepover thing is interesting because it didn't just pop into my head to sleep over. I spent about 6 months or a year trying to figure out how I could deliberately get to know my neighbors. And the thought that came to me at one point was sleeping over at friends' houses as a child. I mean, maybe you did this, but
yeah, sure.
My recollection is, you know, you wake up the next morning in your friend's house and come down to breakfast with his family. And all of a sudden, those other people in the house who were just like your friend's mom or your friend's older sister, they suddenly become real people. You know, you see them first thing in the morning. You get a sense of what their day is going to be like. You see the relationship one to the other. And so that was the origin of the sleepovers.
You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're talking with Peter Loewenheim, author of In the Neighborhood. Be back with more with him after a short break. And welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane today. Diane is off working with other public radio stations across the country. We're talking with Peter Loewenheim. He's author of In the Neighborhood, The Search for Community on an American Street, One Sleepover at a Time. Now, I should say, and we're going to get to these in a moment, Peter, that there are a ton of calls already, and we've got a bunch of tweets here. You seem to have touched a nerve. Some people are saying, and as I say, we'll get to the specifics in a moment, that I've known all my neighbors. What are you talking about? And others saying, you know, wow, I don't know anybody on my street. But I want to come back to Lou, the character in your book, the elderly gentleman we were talking about for a moment. He's the first character that you start with in a big way, and you sleep over at his home. And you talk about his situation, how he woke up one morning at 2 a.m. and he couldn't move, and there was really, you know, his daughter was some way across town, and you go through an exchange with him, and it concludes in a very dramatic way when he says, and you quote him here, he says, "No one cares, no one wants to be bothered. They are not neighbors in the truest sense of the word. There are no neighbors here." What a terribly sad thing to hear from someone.
Yeah, I think it was
who's lived there for how long?
Lou had lived there 50 years.
50 years.
Yeah, and not only that, he had been a very successful surgeon in our community. And it hurt me to think that somebody who had served our community his whole career like that, at the end of his life, was essentially alone in his house.
And you've concluded that this is some kind of epidemic in America?
Well, let me say again, there are, in every city, neighborhoods where people do have a strong community bond, and that is those are notable exceptions, however, to a general trend, which I think Lou's experience represents.
Okay, so here are some of the tweets we've gotten.
Okay.
All right, because we're hearing from people left and right, neighbors on both sides. In almost 2 years, I've gotten to know almost all my neighbors, have been in their homes. On my block, there's only one I don't know, writes one. Another, wish I knew him better. Folks are pretty closed off, especially in a mixed racial and socioeconomic hood. Thoughts? One more. Living in Orlando, Florida, our neighbors are mostly timeshare vacationers. We never know them except perhaps the homeowners. And finally this, we talk when we do lawn work, otherwise nothing.
Mm-hmm. So why is this? Why is this where we've come to as a society? I think that, in whatever kind of neighborhood we live in, we're all subject to the same social forces. Our lives are speeded up. We have a lot of two-career couples, a lot of single parents, where people have limited time. We're spending more time in front of the television set and a lot more time in front of the computer. So all that takes away from the opportunity to spend casual daily contacts with the people, ironically, who live closest to us.
You have another character, a woman by the name of Sandra, and she comments, and I wonder if this doesn't play right into this in some of these comments we just got. The public space today has largely been privatized. That is, private commercial spaces like video stores, supermarkets, chain bookstores are the new public spaces. And if you want to meet people, that's where you tend to go. And the suggestion is that somehow doesn't replace the backyard fence or barbecue or a deeper friendship.
Right. A lot of people say, well, I don't have to know my neighbors. You know, I can go to the big chain bookstore and hang out there with a coffee and I'll run into people. And that's true. But the people, you know, if you actually did meet a friend just by chance, meet a new acquaintance at the big chain bookstore cafe, that's wonderful. But I don't think you're going to end up seeing that person daily in a casual, sustained way as you would a neighbor.
And you say, I can't make friends quite the same way just over the tomatoes and talking about the coupons that I'm checking out.
Yeah. The irony also, I thought about this, about these, the big chain bookstore is, in some ways, that bookstore knows me better than some of the people who live nearby me.
Oh, they know you better than you know you.
I mean,
they know everything.
They know what I read. They know what music I listen to. They know the rhythm of when I go to the store. Just an irony there about how what had been public space has been privatized. But that also raises the other issue that a lot of, structurally, a lot of neighborhoods in the last 20, 30 years have simply not been built with any public space.
You make me think a little bit of Bowling Alone.
Well, sure. Robert Putnam, his groundbreaking book about the decline in this aspect of our society, provides a lot of basis for this.
You have a character. Grace Field is her name.
Grace, yeah.
Tell me about Grace.
Oh, Grace is fascinating. Grace is a woman who did not live in my neighborhood, but my neighborhood is quite lovely. It has a wide street and lovely trees and sidewalks. And Grace used to come to the neighborhood. She'd drive to the neighborhood and then walk for exercise. She'd walk about 2 miles a day. The remarkable thing about Grace is she did this every day for 40 years, starting in 1960. And I remember her as a boy in the neighborhood, just watching her walk every day.
She did that today. Somebody might call the police.
Huh? I never spoke to her when I was young, but when I started doing the research for this book, well, there was Grace still walking in my neighborhood, now in her late 80s, I assume. She's a thin, thin, petite woman. So I finally approached her, very cautiously and introduced myself.
And asked if you could sleep over?
No, I didn't. I just told her that, gee, I've seen you walk in this neighborhood so long. And she told me yes for 40 years. And she eventually did agree to sit down and let me speak with her about her experience. And what I learned was that Grace, though she had walked in my neighborhood for 40 years, had never been approached by anybody. She essentially was, I would say, inviting us to be neighbors with her, and nobody ever did.
Peter,
could I add?
Sure.
It's a tremendous loss, because what I learned about Grace was, as a young woman, she was a graduate of the Juilliard School, She was a pianist and a harpist. And what a missed opportunity, because if we had gotten to know her years earlier, she might have enriched the whole neighborhood, giving perhaps piano and harp lessons to some of the children in the community.
Did you ask her about her neighborhood?
Yes. Grace lived not too far away in a neighborhood of modest homes at that time. Subsequently, she moved to an apartment nearby. But she didn't express a desire to live in our neighborhood. She just liked walking through it because of its beauty.
Did she have a neighborhood in her neighborhood?
I'm not sure that she said that she did, as I recall. And she was pretty isolated in her apartment by the time I met her there.
I want to go to the phones. We've got a lot of calls, as I mentioned, and I want to start with Lois in Cincinnati. Lois, thanks for joining us. Thanks for calling and for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Peter.
Yes, I wanted to say that I live in a neighborhood in Cincinnati. It is 5 to 10 minutes from the inner city, so it's not way out in the burbs, and we have a real neighborhood. But I've noticed that newer people that move into our neighborhood, which doesn't happen all that often since most of us have been here over 30 years, don't seem to want to become part of the neighborhood.
So you've been in your neighborhood. You've been in your neighborhood for. I just want to ask a couple of questions of you. You've been in your neighborhood for 30 years, right?
Yes, over 30.
Over 30. And did when you moved in your neighborhood, I'm just curious. When you moved in your neighborhood and your other neighbors who have been there the same time and who are your friends moved in the neighborhood, did you all have kids together?
Yes, somewhat.
Somewhat.
Some of the kids were older.
Okay.
Some of the people had kids our children's age. Some of them had children who were, you know, older, grown up, maybe college or even after.
Okay, so you were all a bit all over the place. It wasn't just one kind of crowd.
Right, no.
And you're noticing it, and you're saying you're noticing a difference today.
Yes.
With less interest in engaging one another.
Yes, it seems so. I mean, on Halloween, everybody opens their doors, and the kids, mostly grandkids now, will come back and, you know, go trick-or-treating. But there's not, I don't know these other people. And when we have parties and invite everyone in the neighborhood, not everyone comes.
Okay, Lois, thanks. Peter, thoughts?
Well, that's a pretty typical situation. There are some interesting things that neighborhoods around the country are doing that I've found out since I started working on the book. In Columbus, Ohio, for example, there's a neighborhood of older homes. They all have front porches, which is nice. And about 7 years ago, they started what is now a tradition called Wednesdays on the Porch. And during the warm months, everybody takes a turn hosting a party on their porch, which is nice because you don't have to clean up your house. You know, you only have to have the front porch tidy.
I have to clean up my front porch.
Right. But they've been doing this, they tell me, for 7 years. And over that time, they estimate about 85 neighbors have hosted Wednesdays on the Porch. So this might be something that can be tried in other neighborhoods.
Do you notice that, you know, I don't know, neighborhoods where there are garages and people push the remote in their car and the garage goes up and they pull in their garage and then are different than neighborhoods with front porches or where people park on the street? I mean, are these just all interchangeable neighborhoods or are there certain physical characteristics that actually matter?
Well, physical characteristics do matter, although let me say that I think ultimately it's the people who make the difference. But certainly, if you have front porches, that's a great inducement to be able to say hi to people as they walk by, as long as the setback is not too great from the street.
All right, let's go to Cole from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hi, Cole. Thanks for calling.
Oh, I don't know where I'm going.
Cole, you there?
Yes.
Go ahead with your question. You're on the air.
Hello. How did this murder and suicide compel you to have sleepovers instead of a block party or a barbecue?
So Cole's asking a question. Why did you start sleeping over instead of inviting all your neighbors into your backyard?
Hey, Cole, that's a great question. Thank you. I think because I wanted to get to know at least some of my neighbors in a very deep and intimate way. I wanted to see what their lives were like from inside their own homes, if I could. And the nice thing is, now that I know many of the neighbors well, and I think I, you know, having a party would be a lot of fun because we know each other now. I think if starting with a party might not have achieved quite what I was looking for.
We're talking with Peter Lovenheim. He's author of In the Neighborhood, The Search for Community on an American Street, One Sleepover at a Time. Only a journalist would come up with the idea of sleeping over like that and digging into people and their lives in quite that way. I'm Frank Sesno, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, we'd love for you to do that at 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Or you can tweet, as some of our listeners have done today as well. I mentioned a moment ago the question of kids, because our experience with our families in the neighborhoods we were in, we went into one neighborhood, it was a fairly new neighborhood, houses were being built, and everybody who was coming in seemed to have kids. And there was an incredibly strong community bond because people were going to the bus stop together, people were trading babysitters together, or we had a co-op babysitting thing going for a while. And it seemed to be the children that really brought that neighborhood together. And as we've grown up and grown older, that kind of interaction with your neighborhoods is much more difficult. How much did you factor that into this work? That is, where people are in their lives.
Well, that is a important factor, and certainly, you know, neighborhoods with a lot of small children are more inclined to be close neighborhoods, particularly if it's what we call a front yard neighborhood as opposed to a backyard neighborhood. If the kids are all in the backyard playing, it's not going to make that much difference. The nicest thing, though, would be a neighborhood where you have some public space, even what's sometimes called a pocket park, you know, just a little park, where all the kids can gather. There's a community I'd like to mention on the North Shore of Cleveland, where they have taken vacant lots and turned them into community parks. One is neighbors got together and built a playground. And on the other one, they built a picnic shelter, and they use that for community events. Some neighbors have actually gotten married there. So if you have some public space, it really takes advantage of there being small kids in the community.
Your street that you write about is in Rochester. We have a caller, Sue, from Rochester, who's calling in with a question. Hi, Sue. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. And I'm just calling because Peter, you're just painting such a bleak picture, but a few blocks away from where you live, we have a strong neighborhood, 22 families, it's mixed kids, retirees, and we all get together. We make a point to get together at least twice a year, but the women get together at least once a month, either going out to dinner. We have an informal bitch and bond session at different people's homes. And I'm trying to put my finger on why we're different or why it happened, but it takes work. Sometimes it seems easy.
Do you have sort of a neighborhood organizer? Is there one person
or a couple people who
drive this?
No, everyone takes turns, and people send out emails. Well, it's time for dinner. Let's go and let's do a neighborhood picnic. But it never lapses either, and it's a very strong. People have supported each other through tragedies and different things, and it's so important, and I think that's what we recognize in the neighborhood among the families. It is so important. But on the other hand, there are one or two families that don't ever participate either. We will invite them, but they won't participate. So it's not totally all-inclusive, but yet still very strong.
Thanks, Sue. Peter, same, you know, she's not far from you.
Yeah.
Different experience.
I mean, this is terrific that she enjoys such a wonderful community where she lives. And she makes a very good point that, you can have a closely bonded community, a neighborhood, you know, just adjacent to one that doesn't quite do that. And these things can change over time also. I'm glad to say, by the way, my neighborhood today, I think is a more open and friendly even than it was, 5 years ago when I did most of the research for my book.
Why?
Well, I think people, you know, there's some turnover in families. There's younger kids. People are more aware, perhaps.
Have you taken the lead in pulling people together as a result of this?
Well, I think through the writing, I've tried to do that, but other people are doing it too now. And so the point I I want to make is that neighborhoods change over time, and sometimes they go from sort of cold to warm and back again. And I think most of it depends on just the mix of people there.
All right. We are talking with Peter Lovenheim. He is author of In the Neighborhood, The Search for Community on an American Street, One Sleepover at a Time, pointing out again it is one American street, but perhaps an American story. I'm Frank Sesno. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back with more of your calls and questions about your neighborhood and our community.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, autobiography of a recovering skinhead. Frank Mink was out for blood and feeding on hate.
I was this kid that was like a shaken up soda bottle, and that was just waiting for someone to open it and spray it in the direction they wanted it to go. And it just happened to be this movement.
Mink's defection from the white supremacy movement is the subject of his new memoir. Join us.
Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane today, and we are talking about an absolutely fascinating topic with Peter Lovenheim. He's author of a new book just published yesterday, you said, Peter, right?
Yes.
Yeah, just yesterday, called In the Neighborhood, The Search for Community on an American Street, One Sleepover at a Time. And Peter, I have to tell you, I've never seen anything quite like this, because we're inundated with emails on all different topics and lots of phone calls, people asking all sorts of questions. So I want to go right to some of these, and let's tick through them.
Okay.
Several people are asking about the sleepover idea here. Here's one from Marion. Did anyone refuse to let you sleep over? I think I'd be uncomfortable having a neighbor sleep over, and I live in a great community.
Yes. I mean, not everybody agreed to let me sleep over. But surprisingly, most did. A majority of the people who I approached ultimately said yes. And I was very gratified by the trust they seemed to place in me to do that. But the people who declined, I have to say, also expressed a similar desire to live with a common sense of humanity, to know their neighbors and to be known by their neighbors.
So did the people who declined, did you just ignore them, or did you end up having coffee with them and still including them as part of your discussion and research?
Well, the ones who declined, they were just choosing their personal privacy, and I respect that.
So, I know, but did you end up talking to them and bringing them into the conversation, finding out what their story were?
Well, in some cases, but I did not include them in the book at their request.
Here's another one. This is really interesting. This is from April, from Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm single. I've moved several times as an adult. I never took time to meet my neighbors, she writes. But about 2 years ago, I got a dog for the first time. And now I know everyone on my street. And I've made friends with several other dog walkers.
Yeah, dogs are a good way to meet people, certainly.
But these are activities. It suggests an activity that brings people together or defines people perhaps from the big neighborhood into a, you know, you have kids and you do the things with other parents and people who have kids. You have dogs, you do other...
Yeah, but there, you know, it's worth noting that there is a difference between... you know, meeting another dog walker, introducing your dogs, and then yourself. And, I mean, sometimes you can end up having the same kind of casual conversation, you know, 10 times in a row when you meet other dog walkers. And you can be left without really, you know, an enriching, deeper relationship of the kind I'm talking about. So meeting people through the dogs is good. It's just that you have to kind of put yourself out there a little bit to deepen the relationship.
You do have to work at this. I mean, people have to have a determination to invest some time and some effort, because it's really easy to get caught up in your routine and come and go, whereas you've either got to schedule time, and we've had a couple of callers who've talked about that, or create some activity where people can pull together.
Right. I mean, sometimes I find myself spending hours a day just on the computer doing my email.
Okay, well, now this is great, because you raised the issue of computer, and it's suggested in your book that maybe these things are driving us apart. But here's one from Terry, from State College, Pennsylvania. Our neighborhood has its own listserv, Terry writes. Using this just a couple of days ago, a found dog was quickly reunited with his owners via the grapevine. We use the listserv to discuss everything from planning commission topics to best electricians for older homes.
So yeah, this is important. Right. The internet cuts both ways on this issue, as I found. It can either keep people from connecting, or you can use it to connect. And in my book, I talk about two social networking services that are dedicated to enriching neighborhood relationships. One is called meettheneighbors.org, and the other is ineighbors.org. And these are both available to people. You can sign up for this as an apartment building, the whole building, or a suburban neighborhood, you know, the whole neighborhood. And these services and others like them will allow neighbors to communicate, as with a listserv, to send email, to plan parties, all the things you want to do to keep in touch.
To the phones now, and Nicole, who's calling in from Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, Nicole.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. Go ahead with your question.
Well, actually, I wanted to start with kind of an admonishment of the people who are lamenting that they don't know their neighbors, because it's actually really easy. And then I thought I might offer this. Take them cookies. Take them a bottle of wine. Attach a card that says, hello. And it might be a new neighbor, or it might be somebody who you've lived next door to for 5 years and never met. Let them know who you are, and chances are they will reciprocate.
That's a really good point. I mean, Peter, it took the tragedy to kind of make you say, I need to connect with my neighbors better. And yet, this is the neighborhood you grew up in as a kid. Why weren't you taking those cookies or reaching out or doing the kinds of things that Nicole just suggested before the tragedy?
Yeah, it's guilty as charged. It's a good point. I think I'm subject to all the same social forces as everybody else. It just didn't seem something that I needed to do. I didn't think about this issue until that tragedy occurred. But the caller's right. You know, you don't have to sleep over at your neighbor's house. You can take cookies, you can make a call, you can ring the doorbell, leave a card.
Is it easier or harder for younger or older people, in your view and from your research, to do this reaching out? I mean, because you think of people and how, you know, they're behaving,
I think,
and how much technology they've got in their lives and how many demands they've got on their time.
I think there are a lot of older people living alone in our country, in our neighborhoods, and I think just being respectful to them, you know, those who are younger ought to make the approach to those who are older, rather than wait for the older person to do that.
On the phone, Brian from Elkhart, Indiana. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Doug.
Great.
Yeah, I obviously live in kind of Amish Central here, And, you know, a lot of people have this misconception that the Amish don't have cars or like cars because they're opposed to the car themselves. But one of the main reasons they don't have them is because with cars, you can drive all over the place, you can drive miles away, and you basically wreck community. So part of the idea of, you know, being in that, being accessible to the community and not being able to get outside the community, you keep that together. And the other thing that I think we can learn from them maybe is it's not just the community, but as many will know that have been around the Amish community, you know, the old-fashioned barn raising, is this whole idea of, you know, bearing one another's burdens has kind of gone from the community. It's kind of, you know, I'm self-sufficient, I do my own thing, don't bother me. And, you know, years back it was, you know, you shared equipment, you shared tools, you shared food, you shared all sorts of things. And we cared about what happened to the other person. And even if we have community without that general understanding toward each other, and we see that in related to things, you know, as broad as healthcare. You know, I got mine and forget you. So I think it's more than just community. It's, you know, it's a loss of this idea of caring for each other.
Peter?
I like the caller's point about the car making it so easy to kind of ignore our immediate neighbors and take our social lives elsewhere. It reminds me of an interesting phenomenon, which is that often when natural disasters occur and people are not able to use their cars, they're stuck in their houses, maybe there's no electricity, you very often see neighbors suddenly coming out of their houses on foot and connecting in a way that they previously had not. I had a letter from a person who experienced a Florida hurricane, Hurricane Wilma, some years ago. And he describes how for the first time in his life, and he lives in Hollywood, Florida, neighbors came out and they shared things and they got to know each other. They swapped life stories and tips on how to live without electricity, he says. Each day we would check up on each other. And he said, when the power finally came back on, doors and windows closed, air conditioners came back on, and we all went back to our separate lives. And he concluded, and I love this line, I'm almost hoping for another storm so we can all catch up.
I love the point about the air conditioning and the windows. I'm a sort of holdout. I'm from New England way back when, and so I prefer not to have the air conditioning on. I love having my windows open.
You live in Washington, D.C. without air conditioning?
No, but I'm the last one in my neighborhood to turn the AC on. But there's something about that open window. There's something about the noise from next door. There's something about connecting through your walls and your lives with the people around you, even if it's only hearing a lawnmower in the distance or a child, you know, calling out for mom or screaming because they want something.
Yeah, you remind me of one of my favorite scenes that I write about in the book, and it does involve my older neighbor, Lou Gazzetta. It was spring, and I was walking by his house, and Lou was in his house washing the windows from the inside, and I approached him. I wanted to, you know, say hello, see how he was doing. So I walked across his front lawn toward the window, and then I realized that he was not only, that in washing the window, he'd removed the screen. So suddenly there I was standing in front of Lou, who was inside his house. But there was no window and there was no screen. There was nothing separating us. And it was kind of a magic moment. And it to me, anyway, it sort of captured what we had been able to achieve. There was nothing separating us.
Philip joins us now by phone from Dallas, Texas. Hi, Philip. Thanks for waiting.
Oh, thank you. I just had a question for Peter. And with the data that you collected from your neighbors, the way you, I guess, approached them and did an actual sleepover, do you think it was actually good data and good experiences? Because I know whenever I bring company to my parents' house, they act a completely different way as if it was just me, a family member, coming over.
Yeah, it's a good point. And I was very concerned about that going in. I made a point to tell everybody, look, I just want you to do your normal day. Don't do anything special because I'm here. I know it's not possible, but I think because the sleepover followed many weeks of getting to know each other through interviews and going out, I would accompany people shopping and going to their work. By the time I actually did the sleepover, you know, they were pretty used to having me hanging around. And also, I asked myself, if somebody slept over at my house, what would they see? You know, how much would I pretty things up? And I'd probably spend less time online, maybe do the dishes a little sooner, but somebody would pretty much see 90% of what my real daily life inside my home looks like.
Our guest is Peter Loewenheim. His book is In the Neighborhood, The Search for Community on an American Street, One Sleepover at a Time. His story, sleeping over at his neighbor's to get to know them better, hear their stories, learn about them. The caller, Philip, raises a question, though that I'd like to pause and explore a little bit further with you, and that is the data that you use or the research. Scientists would look at this and say, wow, this is a lovely story, but it's one street based on no hard data. You're making a broad generalization about the state of American culture and society. What do you build that on? Where's your foundation of actual research? How would you address that?
I'm not presuming to be a social scientist. I'm a journalist here. But I think that the data that we have from census data about people living alone, the general social survey, which is a survey of Americans done periodically for decades, shows consistently a decline in contacts between neighbors. Certainly Robert Putnam in Bowling Alone gave us a lot of data to support that. But I think it's an important issue in terms of our society, because I think the neighborhood is a fundamental building block of a democratic civil society. And when we lose the opportunity to have casual daily discourse with people who we live near, I think we sort of coarsen our society, and we lose the opportunity to learn about each other. If I could, I would like to just read one letter I received.
Please do.
Which I close my book with. It's from a woman named Pamela from Jackson, Mississippi. Unfortunately, I don't know her last name. But she wrote. She writes to me, "Yes, we all have family and friends, but neighbors are special. They are people who look out for you every day because they are there every day. They are people you can look out for every day because you care. If we all cared about our neighbors, we could change the world one street at a time."
One neighbor, one street, one community at a time. We're talking to Peter Loewenheim, In the Neighborhood, The Search for Community on American Street, One Sleepover at a Time. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And in our final few minutes, if you'd like to call us, 1-800-433-8850. Peter, let's go to the phones and Barbie, who calls in from Weston, Florida. Hi, Barbie.
Hi, how are you today?
Just great. Thanks so much for your call, and thanks for waiting patiently.
Oh, my pleasure. I enjoy the show. I moved into a neighborhood, a townhouse neighborhood, about 17 years ago, and the neighborhood, everybody was a mixture, young, old, some with children, some with older children, some with none. And every other Sunday, we would push the cars back, and we'd bring out the barbecue, and we'd have tables, and everybody was very close. Lately, though, we have had an influx of people that don't necessarily speak English. And the neighbors have just become closed-door neighbors. I always say, hi, how are you, good morning, good afternoon. But half the time, they just nod their head and they keep walking. I try to round up everyone, let's have a Sunday barbecue or something. Nobody is interested anymore. And I think it's pretty sad because it's a great way to learn about other people in their country. It's a great way to learn about America. It's a great way to learn about people other than your own little tight-knit group.
Yeah, it sure is. And it sort of raises, doesn't it, Peter, the issue of diversity as our communities change. It's both our strength, we know, but sometimes it's hard to communicate through language and cultural barriers.
That's true, and it just may take, keep trying some different ways until you find something that works.
Your advice to people, based on your sleepovers and your experience, who listen to this conversation say, yeah, you know, I used to spend time with my neighbors. We used to be a neighborhood. Or, you know, and it's not quite that bad, but it could be better. What do you think people should do to bring their neighborhoods together?
Well, I would say just make it better. You know, take the first step. Ring a doorbell, make a phone call, take over some cookies. And some things don't work, and some things do. Keep trying.
Front porch?
Well, you really can't put a front porch on your house if it's not there, I suppose. Although maybe you could.
You live in a city in a big apartment building?
I know some people who have taken the initiative to make up a little flyer and slide it under the door of their apartment building because they tell me, you know, there's people on my floor. I've lived here for 12 years, and I just have a nodding acquaintance with people who are just on the other side of the wall.
You live in a sprawling suburban neighborhood.
Yeah. Bake some cookies, you know, make a phone call. Ring a doorbell.
I think we could all make fresh lemonade and go down like we used to do and 5 cents. Say it's a money loser, big deal. Call it a loss leader. And put it out and let people stop by and drink the lemonade, unless they're too suspicious to drink the lemonade, in which case you just got your sequel. I'd like to dedicate our conversation today, Peter, to because I think it's very thoughtful and provocative, to our neighborhood, where we've had some tragedy and people who are up against some adversity, but people have come together in really inspiring ways. And so my hat's off to all of them and to neighborhoods across this country that are reaching out across the challenges. And thank you for your book and your very thoughtful observations.
Thank you for having me here.
Peter Loewenheim, In the Neighborhood, The Search for Community on an American Street, One Sleepover at a Time. You've been listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Thanks for being with us. I'm Frank Sesno.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.